may have, there may be a difference today from what was going on in the 80s, in the late 60s. I'm not sure, but I would, if people could speak to that, I would really like to know more as to how that strikes you.
Just before we go on, I should respond to what Martha Dementiev said. When this commission was in Monick and Tunimic last week, it was made clear to them that the commission was appointed by the ICC and that the job was to obtain the views of Village Alaska and Alaska Natives living in urban centers and to write a report based on what they said to enable Native people to plan their own future in light of 1991 and the other questions of Native land and governance that have arisen. Whoever it was spoke to you on the phone, I think, was confusing this commission with the 1985 study under the Interior Department. I didn't mention that study when I was in the villages because I thought it would confuse people. You know, if people think that this the Department of Interior is going to adopt the views of this commission as its Bible, I'm not certain whether you all would look upon that as good or bad, but I think that's a misunderstanding, I really do. Byron Malott, you wanted to carry on from there. And
well, if I could, just speaking to the IRA issue, I guess what it boils down to for me is that I don't want to exchange one set of problems for another. And while there may be meaningful application for any new structure that may be devised, I think maybe one of the things that we need to look for are some standard by which the opportunity generally might be available to apply some and to utilize some other institution, but it should not be mandated universally, maybe. There may be instances in which it makes eminent sense in one area or one region or one community, but might not be meaningful in some other set of circumstances. The question that David posed, I think, you know, we talk about flaws, and I hope that at some point we would be able to talk about some of the positive aspects of ANCSA since 1970. Gosh, that was a long time ago. 72, geez. And I think that Native people are in a holding pattern for their future, substantially better off and with greater opportunity as a result of ANCSA than might have been the case without it. And I think that at some point that has to be explored. But looking at both 1991 and at the question that David posed, anybody without economic freedom does not have a choice, really, if they're asked to make an economic decision. And I think that's very much the case with Alaska Native people. And also, individual ownership, which has personal economic value, only at the expense of destroying the institution, is a fatal flaw in ANCSA. That is, if the only way we can realize personal economic gain is to sell your stock with the value that it is attached to that, not just from the operations of the corporation, but the value that is attached to the land in the institution, is a very grave problem for the future of ANCSA. And I think that that's something that we really need to spend some time with. And the business of unity and common cause, in the light of that choice which we will be forced to make in a very few years, I think is probably more than anything else a forced decision which will result in fragmentation and destruction of a significant institutional opportunity for Native people to pursue their future. You know, to look at ANCSA as a land settlement, additionally, there was a recognition of Native people as Native people and having all sorts of other desires. Partly that was recognized in Section 2C, which was that study which was mandated on the status of Natives to be done by the Secretary of the Interior and then submitted to Congress for action. Well, by the time the 2C study was done, the door had shut, in my judgment, in terms of public policy and public attitudes. And it was not something that we could use as a tool or as a vehicle to advance other desires and interests of Native people. In the early 1970s and as we moved into the mid-1970s, the kinds of opportunities for us were really gone to a substantial degree, those that existed in the mid-60s. And so the 2C, for all that it was, it might have implied for looking at the status of Native people and making some judgments about how Congress could make some mid-course adjustments in the trajectory of ANCSA, really became meaningless. And this business of anything, and I'll use the word gushy, you know, what Native people can do for themselves and bilingual education and everything else, we don't control those institutions. We don't control or impact in any significant way the public policy that creates the framework within which those systems operate. And I think that the entire public policy attitude continues to flow against those kinds of opportunities, which, to shorten, which certainly could become a very long monologue, makes it much more important that Native people unify on issues that they understand and can prioritize than ever. And what we tend to be faced with are opportunities for divergence and opportunities for disunity as a result of trying to make this bloody thing called ANCSA work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to respond to the question that David Case asked. It relates to what we're stuck with, and that is Congress mandated the regional corporations to incorporate under Alaska state corporate laws, and we chose the profit corporate structure for both our villages and the regional corporation. Now, in identifying the Alaska state corporate structure, it has no governmental powers. It's business just as much as Fred Paul said, General Motors and Ford Motors were. The only difference between our regional corporation and those other corporations, Ford Motors and General Motors, is that we have shareholders each given 100 shares each, whereas nobody told Ford Motor or General Motors to have so many shareholders or give so much to them. Now, how does that relate to maintaining our culture and providing our people with their lifestyle, their own original Aborigine lifestyle, We don't have those powers. During the lobbying of the Alaska Native land claims, we had some intelligence coming from Washington, D.C. on how Congress was reacting. And we knew that we were going to be stuck with 40 million acres of land, and Arctic Slope's portion of that was going to be only 5 million. Now that gave us concern about, wow, we're losing control over 51 million acres out of this. So what did we do? We worked very close with our counsel, Charlie Edwardson Jr., and the people that knew what a borough concept was. It was already in the Alaska state law, and I say that the framers of the Alaska state constitution did it so well for us. It caused us to exercise self-determination so that the regional corporation wouldn't be stuck with delivering those services which we had no business doing except make profit and issue dividends and be the stewards for our stockholders. Now, having the Alaska State Voluntary Borrow Act, it was just a matter of us getting into the administration and getting it executed so that we can have an election for our own borough mayor, our own assemblyman, and our own independent school district school board. Now that's where you get your own grassroots voice on how we want our borough government to function. Of course, we have to want them to be accountable for all the tax money they've gotten from private industry. And sometimes it's hard to make public servants accountable. Well, having that, we also got into more intelligence saying that Congress is going to adopt a corporate vehicle. So we got together and got the North Slope, not the North Slope, but the Inupiat Community of the Arctic, IRA Corporation, that we were hoping would be the vehicle to receive the lands and monies. Now, having an IRA, which was incorporated under 16 of the Act, I don't think we got into the 17 part, but at least we were ready to be the vehicle to receive the monies and lands. But Congress, in its infinite wisdom, said, no, you will incorporate under Alaska state corporate laws. In causing the North Slope Borough to be incorporated, we were able to cause them to deliver the services that governments are supposed to do. And this left the regional corporation to go out and do business with the free enterprise system. Now, I've been asked, you know, what's going to happen when the Anglo-American moves up there and develop some enclaves where they will outnumber you. I'm just hoping that we will have enough concerned citizens to cause our North Slope Borough to be accountable and still have the best borough government that Alaska State can have, one that we can be proud of, the ones that our children that are going to eventually be leaders in that government will still maintain the proper delivery of service and provide us with the type of education that we want. Now, getting back to the regional corporation, you know, out of our profits, we can develop some programs so that we can make monies available for scholarship, loans, and grants to our students to go to college. Those are the things that we can do, but we have to make profit before we can actually make monies available to them. Well, thank goodness, our associations with the oil companies have made those monies available, so we are having our quota of young people going to college and also maintaining the level of bilingual education that they would like to have, each community would like to have. Thank you.
Mr. Ufix and Mr. Borbridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to start off by commenting to Mr. Ufixson. He asked what would happen if enough non-natives moved up there and formed various enclaves. What we would have would be the racial enclaves prohibited by Senator Jackson in the ANCSA bill. Mr. Chairman, and I had the privilege of serving for 2 years on the American Indian Policy Review Commission, in which in all probability I spent more time learning than I contributed, although I hope that I was able to represent the viewpoints that were anticipated to be offered by me. But if one overriding theme to which I referred yesterday came through, it was the desire of the Indian tribes across the country to maintain their identity as Indian tribes and to aspire for the same elements of cultural integrity that we have been discussing since the hearings opened. I think, too, I heard the same concerns about the land base. And the Indian tribes that testified in field hearings that we held and in those that were conducted in Washington, D.C., essentially expressed concerns that seemed to, in their minds, to be parallel. To discuss cultural integrity was to discuss a land base. It appeared that, as in one ironic sense, we Alaska Natives benefited from history in this way, and that is Congress had promised in 1884 to take care of the matter of defining through a congressional act whatever rights to land the Natives would have. Where we benefited was that that promise was then laid aside, and in the meantime our people, particularly those in the rural areas, in the villages, continued to follow a lifestyle that was timeless, the subsistence taking of the bounty from the land. As a result, we had the one claim that was pressed as to our lands in which there had been no extinguishment of the Aboriginal title or Indian title on which our claims were based. At the same time in the history of our territory and then state, there had been no clear definition of the status of the what was called native groups, and many of us recall that there were necessary efforts to stretch the meaning of Indian country. Many of us here participated in legislation in which that familiar term and Alaska Natives and Alaska Native villages, and later on the term added, and ANCSA corporations, in order to ensure that we weren't left out in legislation pertaining to American Indians that was also intended to pertain to us. We were also the victims of the indecision over a long period of time of the Department of Interior to arrive at any kind of a decision. Were we in fact tribes up here or not? We lived secure that we were functioning as tribes. We had all the characteristics of tribes. All that we lacked essentially was the backbone by the Interior Department to admit we were in fact tribes. We also lived without the benefit of having a confirmation of title to lands on which we had resided since time immemorial. And so we were a tribe that was not formally recognized, although we functioned as such. We were also a tribe without confirmed title, which would enable us to function as a tribe with a land base, which is more characteristic of most of the Indian tribes in the South 48. And thus what I'm posing is the beginning of what I see as a long evolutionary process in which ANCSA is merely one step in the process. Thus, prior to 71, culminating in December 71, the natives, as was described earlier, were faced with a crisis which threatened the loss of more of their lands. Not just the loss of their lands, meaning those lands which they claimed. There had already been significant losses through selections by the state. Under those pressures and under a need to work within the congressional legislative system, the natives came together, set aside their differences, and sometimes took off the gloves in board meetings. And then after we got through battling on various points, went off to the Congress presenting the facade of serenity and unity on all points, we prevailed and were able to gain title, the confirmation of title to 44 million acres. Now, it may be that the next step is something none of us can foresee, but in terms of looking at the timeless quality of tribes which continue forever, and membership which changes, but who are members of something that continues without end, a tribe, then it appears that the next logical consideration is to combine the timeless quality of the tribe with the land, resulting in a tribe that is land-based. I know that just as you, I can come up with any number of points and arguments as to why this can't be done. I guess they were as numerous as the arguments as to why there couldn't be an Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Sounds very familiar. But that to me would seem to be a logical conclusion to this long evolutionary approach of taking the Alaska Native tribes that have always been here and getting them back together with the land which has always been theirs, and finally recognizing their ownership, however it might take place in terms of, I suppose we must call it a transfer or a relinquishing and transfer from the corporations created under ANCSA to the tribal entities. I'm raising this not so much as a profound conclusion as something that I've begun to ask myself over the period of the last several years. Also, so that I guess in a sentence, I feel strongly that cultural identity and integrity and the land base are essential. I do want to comment also on the proliferation of native and village organizations. Certainly these present opportunities. Many of these organizations arose as a consequence of opportunities to administer programs directly. In that sense, they certainly represented to the fullest the concepts that all of us have of self-determination. But also, of course, there arises with the proliferation prices that we have to pay that were never anticipated at the time. I think part of the result, and I'm not pointing fingers at any region, we have this problem, and no one organization initiates it. It happens. We all have our turf. We all become aware of jurisdiction. We all look to the Act, not only to see what this organization to do should do, but what your organization should do that it isn't. And suddenly we end up talking about this organization is us and your organization is them, and we're all the same tribe and the same people. The other thing I see that happens is that there's a less energetic interaction. There's a less interaction between the various leaders and spokesmen. And quite frankly, our ranks of leadership are too thin to allow that to happen, but we do. I think further, the jurisdictional question has a tendency to cause not intended by any organization or any leader, a paralysis to set in. As one example, I think if we look for one entity that has a timeless quality, it's one that I've mentioned, which in practice will have more than its share of problems in its politics, and that's the tribal governing body. I don't want to suggest there will not be times that we will become very impatient with it or see it wander off the course. But it's timeless. It'll have time to wander back on the course. But here, again, in my opinion, the tribal governing body is vested, I think, with the responsibility for the long-range concerns of the people. For a tribe, to answer the question, where do we want to be in 50 or 100 years, is not all that big a question, because it's consistent with the existence of a tribe and the timeless quality of its existence, where there is no beginning and no end. Sometimes there arises the situation in which a tribal governing body or a nonprofit or some other entity is told directly or indirectly that here is the jurisdiction of a corporation. These matters are corporate matters. You are to leave them to the corporation. Now, here are some very comfortable nonprofit activities in which you might profitably direct your energies. And in fact, I think that the tribal governing body does a disservice to its people when it buys the proposition. And again, I suggest the proposition may sometimes be advanced directly, may sometimes just happen and be accepted as something that should be. I'd like to comment just briefly on the distribution of land assets. I feel strongly that the distribution of land assets, which essentially is a liquidation of the assets of the tribe, ignores the tribal use and occupancy of the land that led to the ownership. I want to stress again that the obligation of all of us is not only to the future, but to the past as well. There is use and occupancy because there were people using, occupying the land and exercising dominion over it. We could assert our Indian title, we could go to Congress because that was happening. We have an obligation to the members of the tribe who are not yet born. We who are here today and those who were alive in 71 were just alive at that time as members of the tribe. But I think if they had voted to distribute the assets and sell the land, they would have done a disservice to the tribe. I view them, to use Mr. Yupikson's comment, they are stewards. They're merely stewards for the ones who will come after. All of us here are descendants of people who didn't understand what it meant to own in fee simple title, because all of our use, all of our occupancy could not be reduced to something on paper. I think the best paper drawn under Western law always leaves something out that the Alaska Natives understood and felt about that land. I feel, therefore, that the distribution of assets at any given point selfishly benefits those who are living at that time, who in fact should be viewing themselves as no more than the caretakers or the stewards. Their function, our function, is to preserve the tribal assets for the future. The clear intention of the native framers of ANCSA was that the land of our forefathers would be preserved for all of us, including those who will come after for some while into the future. I want to close with this, that ANCSA, as I mentioned yesterday, does not reflect the total picture of what the natives tried to incorporate into the law. If you want to understand what the native framers of that law intended, you have to go beyond ANCSA. ANCSA was the result of several years of effort. ANCSA was one of a number of bills introduced into the Congress. ANCSA was the result not only of the lobbying by the native representatives, but it was the result of opposition by powerful, well-financed vested interests. And finally, it was the result of a compromise between one version offered by the U.S. Senate and another version offered by the House. Let me just quickly give some examples. of things that were intended, offered by the native framers, but not adopted into the final law. The subsistence provision, as I mentioned yesterday, was not spelled out in the detail as offered by the AFN representatives, and as was included in the Senate version, the House provision on subsistence prevailed. We, the Alaska Federation of Natives, vigorously supported the concept of a perpetual 2% override. This was only just and only fair. The concepts of Western ownership of land were being thrust on us. So we accepted the proposition of dividing and separating the surface estate from the subsurface or mineral estate. Consistent with Western law, we offered the provision which would provide for a 2% override in perpetuity for the natives. If we truly were treated as owners of the land, we would have had today that perpetual 2% override. I considered this so-called compromise by the Congress one of the most arbitrary, unfair provisions which they pushed upon us. There was consideration of economically valuable non-contiguous lands. Some members of Congress were thrusting on us the notion that all of our lands had to be contiguous, that is, connected in one massive body. And this provision did have support from Senator Jackson that we should have the right to select lands for their economic value. We even had at one point provisions for what we called in-lieu selections. Lands could be selected in other areas. Here's an example, that if one region couldn't satisfy its land selections, it would select lands in another region, and together the two regions would work out a way of managing those lands. Finally, as I also indicated the other day, we had sought to use the Central Council, the tribal governing body, as an ANCSA entity for the purpose of being the administrative entity for Southeast Alaska. In Southeast Alaska, with the election of our ownership, with the functioning of our Central Council, how we operated reflected our organic documents, our rules of election, and our constitution. And in Southeast Alaska, the Central Council had provision for the election of delegates, representing one delegate for each 100 people in the various member communities. We conducted our business by an annual convention, and under the decisions made by an executive committee elected at the annual meetings. Thus, this at least gives some picture of both how the leadership was selected and how it functioned. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Maybe we should see if anybody on this side of the table wants to say something before lunch. Mr. Carter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's difficult to say anything without referring to the rose-colored glasses that many of us wore during the late 60s and early 70s. Of course, we had a great deal of confidence in our own people and their ability to work together without fighting or squabbling. Well, we took those glasses off and we're in the heat of battle. I think it's important to note why certain decisions were made in considering some provisions of ANCSA. Several times the Organic Act of 1884 has been mentioned, where the Congress reserved the right to settle the question at some future time. It's also important to note, I think that was the first time that the laws, civil laws, were applied to the state of Alaska. The laws of Oregon State were applied to the state of Alaska. And I believe that was the time also that the first land laws were applied to the state of Alaska in the mining laws. And subsequently, over the years, even after statehood, the Congress has passed laws dealing with specific land provisions, disposal provisions, whether it be for mining or for community development or for trade and manufacturing sites or for religious institutions. Throughout the state, you'll find small parcels of land, some up 10 acres, 5 acres, 40 acres, up to 400 acres or more, that were included as enclaves and native lands because of laws passed by the Congress of the United States. Mining companies have claims all over the state. Religious organizations have many acres of land. Canneries acquired key locations and sites in the coast of Alaska for fishing enterprises. In town sites that were created, the trustee in many cases allowed non-native acquisition of lands. Within the villages themselves, throughout the state, there are a lot of places where there are stores or other economic activities that are being run by white people. So whether title to specific parcels of land were acquired by acts of Congress or by purchase or inheritance or just by longevity of living there, it was recognized by the native leadership and the people that they should have some title, that their title should be honored. And so the Claims Act provided that not only those individuals that had acquired some interests would be protected in their interests, but that also individual Native persons would have their interests protected, and that in the implementation of ANCSA, we would be required to deed to the individuals their titles. And what they do with their individual titles then is their own business. Another important aspect of our consideration of being a Native and having certain rights and obligations must be viewed in the context of the World War II, when many of our Alaska Natives joined the armed services. And in fact, some of the islands of the Aleutians were invaded by the Japanese. Some of our Native people died fighting for this country. Some of our people today are very, very proud to wear the uniform of the Alaska National Guard. Some are extremely proud that they represent an elite group of first defense of this country as Arctic Eskimo Scouts. It's also important to note that many people today, the elders that we admire and appreciate and look to for guidance, can remember very clearly, because I can, and I'm not an elder, I don't think, can remember very clearly the signs on the bar door, the signs on the restaurant door in the urban centers of Alaska where it says, "No Indians allowed." We can remember very clearly the very blatant public discrimination against Alaska Native people. So it's hard, in view of this blatant discrimination and the pride that we have in fighting for our country, to prioritize the hat we wish to wear. Am I first a Native? Am I first a citizen of this state? Am I first a citizen of the United States? Am I first a human being? So the priority that we view ourselves as individuals, I think, is an individual decision throughout the state, and you will probably hear much reference to that priority classification of each person. The question that Mr. Case raises is an interesting one, and I don't think there's going to be an answer for it. There are many villages in this state, especially the smaller IRA villages, that are looking with a great deal of interest at the outcome of the Tyonek lawsuit case. Tyonek, as you know, is an IRA village. It had instituted rules and regulations for non-natives that they could stay only for limited periods of time with the permission of the people. A lawsuit I don't think it's been concluded, has it, Fred, do you know? Well, some non-native people moved in there and they wanted to stay and the village wanted to run them off, and I think it involved some ownership of property by individuals of the tribe that wanted to rent or sell their places to non-natives. So we're very interested in the ability of that IRA tribal organization through its own rules and regulations to control what they feel is trespass against their tribal entity. I don't know what will happen, because we've viewed over the years the problems of in the United States, the Watts problems that has been alluded to, the other violent reactions that have taken place, whether it be in the Negro communities or in Florida now, where they have a tremendous number of people from down south. But the anti-discrimination laws that are taking place, the court cases involving those things, as a matter of fact, with all respect to the women, the IRA, or whatever they call it, the women's rights movements, the ERA, or women's rights movements of the United States. So whether or not our Alaska Native people will be willing to have ethnically segregated organizational structures in the future, I think is a question for them to answer as time goes on. Thank you.
Mr. McGarvey, would you like to add something before lunch or after lunch? All right, well, let's adjourn until 1:15. Is that all right? Just before we do, could I raise a couple of questions that you might think about? Mr. Malott said that the act had a number of weaknesses. One is, he said, that it created the opportunity for Alaska Natives to destroy each other, and he and others might discuss that. I assumed he was talking about disputes within corporations between shareholders, disputes between the regional and village corporations, disputes between the villages and the IRAs. But if I didn't entirely comprehend that, perhaps Mr. Malott, you and others might pursue it. There's just one other thing. Everybody assumes that in 1991 it would be a good thing to prevent the shares from being sold. That seemed to be the feeling in the villages that we visited last week, and all of you seem to assume that. Is there a body of opinion? Do any of you hold that opinion? But is there a body of opinion among Alaska Natives that isn't represented at this table that says, yes, in 1991, if we want to sell our shares and get some money and buy a house or whatever, a business, we should have that right? Perhaps you might address those questions this afternoon. They seem to me important.
I had to speak at one of the school districts.
Oh, well, thanks for coming. I know you're all busy. Send your best to be here when you could. I sure appreciate it.
I'll try to get some for you. They take up several chapters to go to the local.
I want to do it plain. I hate to speak when I'm holding everybody back.
Yeah. Good idea.
Local government and state government, and how it relates to native government, and comes up with.